Okay. No lecture worksheet today. I'm just going to give you credit, okay?
Woohoo!
We have an exam on Wednesday, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got Wednesday coming up. Tomorrow is Tuesday. And Tuesday is our day to do stuff in class, right?
Right.
So I want to ask you all, shall we work for the exam on Tuesday again?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I've been talking to various people. Bryson was just up there trying to figure this stuff out, and Adam was there trying to figure it out earlier, and I think that maybe that's the best plan. Although I'm worried that there's not, I mean, we need more time than just on Tuesday, probably.
review session, maybe?
Yeah, we could do a review. I have another review session at on Tuesday already for electronics, right, Bryson? Is that right?
Yeah, Tuesday at 5, yeah.
Yeah.
Just review all night.
Right, yeah, just review. I don't have any more exams to hand out, but I'll see what I can come up with. I can make up another one, or come up with some more problems to think about. Okay, for tomorrow that will be my goal. And so tomorrow we will spend working on stuff for the exam on Wednesday. Okay. Now today what I'm going to do in class is, Laplace transforms, which will not be on the exam on Wednesday, okay? The exam on Wednesday is a rehash of what we did on the first exam, okay? So what you need to know for that exam, just a quick review, are you need to know, those Fourier series. You need to know the vector analogy to Fourier series. And by the way, I should mention that there are other orthogonal functions, not just e to the j 2 pi n t over cap t. That's not the only orthogonal function, okay?
You mean like sines?
Yes, sines and cosines are also orthogonal, and there's an infinite number of other ones, okay? Okay, so there's... It just turns out that e to the j 2 pi n t over cap t is the handiest one for us because it's the eigenfunction for every linear time invariant system, okay? And that means that it's the one where what comes out is just a scalar multiplied by what went in. The eigenvalue times what went in is the vector that comes out, okay? And that means it doesn't change directions when you run it through the system. It's kind of like the perfect coordinate system to use for those linear time invariant problems. Oh, good. I don't remember what number was this.
I perceive you are not practicing your Spanish.
We could look on the notes, I suppose. You can put your guess on there.
That was materials.
So anyway,
sounds exciting.
I want to make sure that you're ready for the second exam, this redo, okay? I hate to have redo exams, but they're better than the other alternative, right?
Yeah.
Because I need to make sure that you understand it, right? And when you fail the first exam, that means I've failed here, and so I'm going to give it another shot. Fortunately, time is not yet done. The last trump has not arrived.
This is a 3-credit class?
This is a 4-credit class. Yeah.
That's why we actually meet 4 days a week.
Yeah, we do meet 4 days a week, yeah. I have taken the Tuesdays, the lectures for Tuesday, taken all that material, ripped it out of the thing, and so you have 3 credits worth of stuff, but 4 credits worth of, 1 extra hour worth of practice, okay? So you're trying to make things less, okay? So that you really get it. We took the most important stuff, and we're doing that. So, anyway. Let's look at, now let's see if I can make my computer work here. Let's look at what we did. Oh no. No, press any other button. Okay, let's try this here. How come it's not showing? There it is. Disadvantages of homeschool.
Yeah. That and you generally have to grade your own stuff.
Yeah. That's also another disadvantage. My kids, you know, they can sympathize. They're all having to suffer with homeschool. Okay, so let's do a quick review of what we had done last day. We have a little C program here. Go to bed, return to Z, right? Anyway, we were looking at the Laplace transform, x of t. Here's the Laplace transform, x of t. And, you know, I've been thinking a little bit more about Ben's question here. Ben was asking, are e to the st things, e to the minus sts, are they orthogonal? And so let me do just a little bit of a more of an answer on that. That really what we have is we have x of t times e to the minus sigma t times u of t times e to the minus j omega t dt, okay, integrated from minus infinity to infinity. If we integrate this guy right here, that actually equals this guy right here. Do you see that? Where S equals sigma plus j omega? Okay. Do you see that this is also the Laplace transform? This is equal to the integral here. 0 to infinity of x of t e to the minus st dt, which is the Laplace transform of x of t. Okay. Now, these guys are really the basis functions. They're orthogonal. These are orthogonal basis functions. How do we know this? Let's think about it for just a second. Remember we said e to the j 2 pi n t over cap t were orthogonal basis functions for a periodic function which had a period cap t, right? If we take the limit as cap t goes to infinity, then what happens is those harmonics get closer and closer and closer together, and pretty soon they're spaced out right next to each other, just like the real numbers, okay? And omega is 2 pi f. F is is n over t, okay? So these are just like your Fourier series basis functions, okay? It's just for a very long period. And so they're still orthogonal. So these are orthogonal functions. Those are our old friend, okay? And this is actually the function which you are expanding. You are doing the dot product of this function with the basis functions, okay? And this function, x of t, u of t, that's x of t is the thing, and we put the u of t in there because we're interested in getting a zero here on the lower limit, because that helps us with initial value problems like we saw in the, you know, when we did this, okay? And this e to the minus sigma t, that's a convergence factor. Remember I talked last day about this convergence factor? That's a thing that makes it so that when you do this integral, it actually comes out with something not infinite. When we do regular vectors, we don't usually need a convergence factor on our vectors, because there's only a finite sum. There's not an adding up an infinite number of stuff. It's only, you know, two or three dimensions, right? So we never worry about that when we're doing regular vectors. But we can just think of expanding this thing right here in terms of those orthonormal or orthogonal basis functions right there. And then once we know what this is, we can always, you know, multiply by e to the plus sigma t, and then we got x of t again. So finding the x of t is still quite possible, okay? So what we do is we'll actually do a dot product with the e to the plus j omega t, and then we multiply by e to the plus sigma t, and we'll end up with x of t. And that's actually, if you take signals and systems, we actually show how you do that. Okay, so if you want to know more about this, that's that is, you know, where you learn about this. But this guy right here is actually this is a convergence factor. And maybe I should say actually including the U of T. And we just put that in there just to make sure the integral will converge, you know. But it also gives us this e to the st, which were the solutions to our differential equations, right? And so it's very handy in that regard. It's kind of like pulling us right into where we need to be to get easy solutions, you know, turning differential equations into algebra equations, basically. That's what we're trying to do, make our life easy. So this is just like Fourier series. You know, these are the basis functions. And these are this is the function we're trying to expand in terms of these basis functions. This is an inner product of that thing right there with those basis functions.
Will sigma often add n dependence?
Yeah, sigma is, you know, you might need different sigmas for different x's to make it converge. So you just kind of pick the sigma that makes it work in your case. And in general, you know, suppose this x of t were just a constant like 1 or something, then, you know, the sigma would need to be greater than 1. I mean, greater than 0. And so that thing would, you know, die off exponentially. So that kind of answers, hopefully, Ben's question. He isn't here today, but, you know, hopefully it answers his question where the e to the sts, he was asking, where the e to the minus sts, are those things orthogonal? And no, they're not. This is the thing that's orthogonal. And really, we're thinking about expanding this whole function right here, which includes the function we're interested in, but multiplied by a convergence factor, this e to the minus sigma t u of t. Which just, you know, happens to be a handy kind of convergence factor. So that was that.
So, Dr. Freund, what happens to the u of t when you do that integral?
The u of t is what makes the 0 on the lower limit right here. If I didn't have the u of t, you see, if I went from minus infinity and I didn't have the u of t, when I put in minus infinity, that thing at minus infinity, e to the minus sigma t, is actually gigantic, right? If t was minus infinity, it would be e to the plus some gigantic number, right? E to the plus infinity.
Yeah.
And so I had to put the u of t in here to turn it off for negative t. And I did that so that I get the 0 on the lower limit here for the Laplace transform. And we did that because then it brings in the x of 0 when we did the differential equation. You remember when we were doing this thing, I guess it was where we did do the derivative, it brought in the x of 0, the initial condition. It was back here. We got in this y of 0 here, this initial condition. And that was usually the thing we knew in the initial value problems that we had with these, you know, circuits. You know, we knew what the initial voltage was at time t equals 0, you know, when the switch flipped or whatever. And so that just worked out very handy to put in 0 there, because that was where we happened to know where things were. If you actually, you could do this just as well by doing it a u of t minus 10 or something. And if you knew what y was at time t equals 10 or x was at time t equals 10, it would work out nicely for that kind of a problem, right? But normally we just pick 0 as being the time when we know what things are, right? And so we just put 0 on here.
Although you could arbitrarily define your 0 point
anywhere
that you had an initial point that was negative time.
Sure, yeah, you could do it at minus 10 if you wanted. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, that's just an aside there to try and answer Ben's question, and he isn't even here. So we'll just leave it at that. Yeah. Okay, so let's go back to what we were doing. And what we were starting to do was to come up with some properties, and somewhere here we did the properties. Yeah, we were starting to do some properties here. Like we started labeling Laplace transform dy dt was this, Laplace transform of y of t times s minus the initial value of y. And we did the Laplace transform of e to the at u of t was this. And we did the Laplace transform of the second derivative was, well, turned out to be this, right? Okay, and then didn't we do a procrastination property too? Seems like we did the procrastination property, but I don't see it there.
We procrastinated on it.
Yeah, I'll have to go look in my camera. It's probably still in my camera and I didn't download it or something.
I think that's...
Oh, here it is right here. I just got it in the wrong order. Maybe we did it before. So here's the procrastination property, right? The Laplace transform y of t minus t0, u of t minus t0. That's like what happens if we wait t0 seconds before we do our experiment, right? Before we kick something. So we did this, we did a change of variables, and we ended up with e to the minus st0 times the Laplace transform of y of t. So e to the minus st0 was the procrastination operator. You just multiply by e to the minus st0, and that's the same thing as in time, delaying by amount t0. Okay.
Yeah. So how is it delaying? I know this might be kind of
simple. This is delaying right here.
I would normally think t plus t.
That's a very good question. And I remember I had the same question when I was just like, why do they have minus there? Why does that work out minus? Let's just try and do a little bit of a thing here. So we'll do more properties here. Let me just... we'll just take an aside about that because I had that same question. I still remember that, you know, when I was in this class. Why is it my u of t minus t0 moves it to the right? How can that be? So anyway, so I'll do that over here, a second aside. So this is aside one and this is aside two. So let's look at u of t. U of t is equal to this thing right here, 1 if t is greater than or equal to 0, and 0 if t is less than 0. Let me graph it. Right here, here's the t-axis, here's 0, and it looks like this. Right? This is 1, right? So this is u of t. Do you agree? Does that make sense, Edgar? So that's u of t. Now let me graph. Oh man, I don't know. Oh, I do have my red one. Okay, now I'm going to graph u of t minus 3. Okay? So u of t minus 3, okay, will be equal to, well, I've just got to use this definition of u of t to get u of t minus 3, right? And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to replace every t I see over here in black, I'm going to put a t minus 3 over here. Okay, so I'm going to say 1 if t minus 3 is greater than or equal to 0, and 0 if t minus 3 is less than 0. Did I do that right? See, I just changed every t here to a t minus 3 over here, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if this is the definition for u of t, then if I change t to t minus 3, this better be the definition for u of t minus 3, right? So I just replaced t with t minus 3. No biggie there, right? Well, what does this really turn out to? Well, this guy, t minus 3 being greater than 0, implies that t is greater than or equal to, if I had 3 on both sides, it would be 3, right? And this would be t less than 3, right? So what happens is, here's 3 right here. So u of t minus 3 looks like this, and it jumps up right there instead of there, right? And so this guy is u of t minus 3, right? There you go. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, right? Does that make sense? And so, yeah, it has to be a negative. A negative in the argument moves it to the right. A negative in the argument moves it to the right. A positive in the argument moves it to the left. Okay, if I made the u of t plus 3, this would have turned on over here at minus 3, right? Everybody agree? Okay, so don't feel bad about that. I have that same question. Why is that? You know, if moving it plus, I'm moving it in the plus direction. Why do I put a minus there?
It's kind of like, well, factoring a, sorry. No.
Yeah, it's like factoring.
It's kind of like factoring a polynomial where you look at x minus 3 being
x polynomial. Equals 3, right, yeah. It ends up with x equals 3 when you do it, yeah.
I guess that makes sense.
Yeah. My thought was that when you make it negative, it acts like the wave at that time. And when you make it, it's like shifting it. It is shifting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. So think about it a little more. Maybe it'll make sense. Okay. Okay, so we did the procrastination operator. We've done the derivative operator. Okay. Let's do the Laplace transform of e to the at times x of t. Okay. E to the at x of t. Okay, so that's equal to the integral from 0 to infinity of e to the at x of t e to the minus st dt, right? Just by the definition. Is that okay? Okay, what do I need to do next?
Integrate.
Wave your hands and write an answer.
I want to get this in terms of, I want to get this as a function of x of something here. I want to get this back just like we did over here. Remember when we did the derivative one, we got it in terms of the Laplace transform. See? Notice this was s y of s minus something we knew, right? I want to relate it to, I want to relate this guy to the Laplace transform of x of t, which doesn't have this guy here, right? How can I do that?
We can combine either the at and either the minus at.
Yes! So, excellent. Travis to the rescue. Equals integral from 0 to infinity of x of t e to the minus quantity s minus a t dt. Did I do that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And so what is this? This is x of the Laplace transform of x of t evaluated where? S minus A. Excellent. Notice this. This is a certain symmetry in this whole thing, right? Did you notice this? Notice when I multiplied by this e to the AT here, which is kind of like what we had when we did this, let's look at this this thing here. You see, if I shifted things in time, what did it do? It multiplied by this exponential factor, which turned out to be a, you know, this is the procrastination operator in time. I mean, in S space, this is the what happens when you procrastinate in time. And over here, if you shift in S, if you move about in S, if you shift your function over by an amount of A in S, what does that do? Well, that multiplies by e to the AT in time, okay? It's kind of symmetrical, right? Ooh. And a lot of these things are kind of symmetrical, right? Which makes me wonder, yeah. Is there a symmetrical thing for the derivative? I mean, would there be? I mean, here, you know, we had something like this, right? When we multiplied by s, right? It was like taking dy dt, right? Wasn't it? Kind of? Multiplication met. Yeah, this is kind of like our old friend, you know, if S was J omega, you know, multiplying by J omega was like taking DDT in phasors, right? Well, okay, let's try that. So what about this? If I multiply by, if I do the derivative in, it seems like if I do the derivative in S space, it would kind of be like multiplying by T in time if things were symmetrical, right? Let's try this. What about the Laplace transform of t x of t equals the integral from 0 to infinity of, t, x of t, e to the minus st, dt. Would that be equal to d ds of integral 0 to infinity of x of t e to the minus st dt? It's not quite, is it? What do I got to do? If I got to take the derivative of this guy, what does it do with respect to s? What does it do? Brings down the minus a, minus t, right? If I take the derivative of this guy with respect to, it'd be the dds, this is the only thing with an s in it, right? So it brings down a minus t. Oh, well, I better put a minus then, right? Oh, hey, it works, right? That's not so hard, right? So there's this symmetry going on, right? Does that make sense?
So it, does the... I was just thinking that maybe the symmetry was due to it being a periodic function.
How did the dds be inside the integral?
No.
Yeah. There's actually a little bit of convergence stuff you have to worry about. Can you change? This is a limiting operation here, right? And you have to change it with this integral right here in order to get it inside the integral to do the derivative, right? Of the e to the st. And maybe you kind of remember, suppose I had a thing like this. Suppose I did this limit as x goes to 0 and y goes to 0 of x over y. Now, what does that equal? Well, it depends on which one you do first, doesn't it? If you take x first, then what do you get?
Zero.
And if you take y first, what do you get? And that's a pretty big difference, isn't it? And so what it tells you is sometimes taking limits, when you interchange limiting operations, you are treading on thin ice, right? Okay. Well, if these kind of things bother you, and what I'm saying is I'm cavalierly interchanging the limiting operations, okay? I'm cavalierly doing that because it works okay in this case. But in order to actually prove that it works okay, you have to take, you'll have to take advanced calculus here, and then you'll probably have to take a real analysis and measure theory class in graduate school, and then you can prove that it uniformly converges, and when it uniformly converges, then everything's okay. Okay. So there's a plug for, all you theorists need to take some more math classes.
Why did taking the derivative with respect to s get rid of a t?
Let me just do dds. dds of e to the minus st equals what? Can you answer me that?
Yeah, it's minus t e to the minus st.
Right, okay. So what I did was I took this minus dds and brought it inside the integral. This thing didn't have any s's, so I just popped him outside the derivative, right?
Right.
And then I did this, I did that, and I got a minus t in there, which looks just like this, right?
Okay, so we could, yeah. No, that makes sense now. Okay.
Okay. But, Joe was worried about the interchanging of the limiting operations.
Yeah.
This is a limit, and that's a limit, and, it's a... So what do I do when I do stuff like this, okay? Whenever I do something like this and I'm doing a derivation, I just raise a little flag up, when I do that and say, oh, this might not always work, right? And then when I end up, going down the line and I end up getting like a train wreck or some problem, that's looking like, oh man, this is coming out with nonsense. Then I go back and look at all the little flags that I did along the way and say, well, this might not have been true. Is this really true? So that's at least my approach to these kind of things, okay? So,
S T, why is there no over negative S?
Because you're used to taking the derivative with respect to T down here. I'm taking the derivative with respect to S.
Yeah, but like whenever you take the integral from 0 to infinity up there,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't you get a e to the negative S T over negative T?
Oh, no. Well, it depends on what X of T was, right? This thing could change tremendously depending on what x of t is. Well, if it was u of t, shall we do just do a concrete example here? So example.
So x of t is not u.
And x of t can be anything I want. So let's do an example here. Just for so you can see how this works with, say, x of t being u of t. Okay. So the Laplace transform of t u of t. What is that going to be? Well, let's find out. Okay. Now, what I'm going to do is use this thing right here. Okay. So this is going to equal to minus dds of the Laplace transform of u of t. Right. Using this thing right here. Right. X of t would be u of t. Your example. Right. Okay. Now, did we do the Laplace transform of u of t yet?
I think so, yeah.
It's kind of like this Laplace transform of e to the at u of t if I picked a equals 0, right? If I picked a equals 0, I get 1 over s, right?
Right.
Okay, so it's 1 over s. So this guy is 1 over s. Now, when I take the derivative of 1 over s, I get, that's like s to the minus 1, so I get minus 1 s to the minus 2. So with that minus there, it just becomes s to the minus 2, right? Which is 1 over s squared, right? And that indeed is the Laplace transform of t u of t. Now, we could also do that by integration by parts. Just plug it in here, you know, and do this t e to the at and integrate it by parts. But it's kind of a yucky thing, right? Does that make sense?
So what you've got happening.
I should put in more. I'll put in more details here. I was just trying to motivate why I did it, but let's try this. I'm going to say this is minus the integral from 0 to infinity of minus t. I'm going to put x of t first. I'm going to put x of t times minus t e to the minus st dt, right? And then I'm going to say that's equal to minus, I don't know, am I doing this right? And I've got x of t times dds, oops, not ddt, dds, of e to the minus st dt, right? You agree so far? Because if I take dds of e to the minus st, you said this was just minus t e to the minus st, right?
You just dropped that inside.
So this guy and that guy are the same. This guy right here, I'm going to say this is minus dds of e to the minus st, okay? And so now I've got that right there. Now I'm going to bring this is where the difficulty comes. Okay, it was Joe's problem. I'm going to move that dds outside. So now I'm going to write this as minus dds of the integral 0 to infinity x of t e to the minus st dt, like that. I just brought the x of t inside. That doesn't change the derivative, but then I moved the dds outside the integral, which was the tricky step, or the iffy step, I should say. And then I got this thing right here was, this is just x of s. So what I'm saying is that the Laplace transform of tx of t equals minus dds of the Laplace transform of x. And that's what we did over here. We took Laplace transform of t u of t is minus dds of the Laplace transform of u of t, which ended up being that. Okay? Is that right? Okay.
So being able to solve that any further really depends on what x of t is.
Exactly, exactly. We're just kind of coming up with properties of Laplace transform. The idea is that if in the time domain we multiply by t, what does that do in the s domain? It differentiates with respect to s. So I have a question for you. Would Laplace transforms be good? Let me ask this here. I'll just put it on the board here. Would Laplace transforms be good work well for this problem? T dy dt plus y equals 0. Well, we could do this. Shall we just take the Laplace transform and see what happens? Let's just try it. Okay, so here we go. So t, that's going to mean I'm going to do minus dds, right, of the Laplace transform of dy dt, which is s, y of s, minus y of 0, minus, like that, right? This is the Laplace transform of dy dt, plus y of s equals 0, right? Do you agree? See, the minus dds came from the t, right? And then the Laplace transform of dy dt, I used s y of s minus y of 0. That's this property right here. Right? And then I just said Laplace transform y of t is y of s, right? So now look at this equation and then look at that equation. Did it get any easier? No, it's just it's like jumping from the frying pan into the fire, right? It didn't help. Yeah, I mean, it's the same kind of equation as that is, right? And so you didn't gain anything. So what is this kind of equation right here? This is a linear equation, okay? It's definitely linear, but what is it not?
Laplaceable?
Well, it's certainly Laplaceable. Here's the Laplace, right? It's like a circuit equation where the RC was changing by?
It's not time invariant.
Exactly. It's not time invariant. And so you see what happens is e to the minus or e to the j omega t is the eigenfunction for time invariant systems, but not for time varying systems. And so, you know, when we went to this new coordinate system, the problem was just as hard as the one we started with, right? In fact, it was almost exactly the same problem, right? Does that make sense? So anyway, we got a little bit of practice on our properties there and noticed something interesting. Time invariant systems are easier than time varying ones by, you know, some amount there. Maybe a pretty big amount. Fortunately, most of the time, you know, nobody's twiddling our capacitors back and forth like this, right? I mean, or they change it, and we really don't care what happens. Why they change it is just after they went to the new position, we'll solve that again, right? Anyway, okay, so let's see. We need another property here. We've done the procrastination property. We've multiplied by t. We've differentiated. We've differentiated again. We've multiplied by e to the at. Man, I really want to give you a homework problem, but you have an exam on Wednesday, so I can't do that. So anyway, probably, here's a preview of what's probably going to come, okay? There are in your book, you know, you guys have a book for this thing. And in your book, there is a table of these properties, okay? I'm just kind of going off the top of my head, thinking of one and then another, whatever. And there's some that I've forgotten. You know, I don't remember exactly, you know, what they are right now. I'm not thinking of them. But what I would suggest you need to do, because on the exam, the one that's coming up not this Wednesday, but the one that comes up thereafter, there will be at least one problem on that exam where you will need to be deriving one of these properties like this, okay? And why am I doing that? Well, I'm doing that because I want you to learn all of those properties, okay? And for me, what I found that works the best way to learn them is just to derive them several times, you know, a number of times. And that is the best way to remember them, okay? At least that I found. That's interesting. There was a thing on Slashdot. How many of you guys read Slashdot? You probably don't have time for that. Only old fogies like me get a little time to read, you know, the news, Slashdot. Well, Slashdot is this, you know, news site for nerds, right? Or for geeks or whatever, I don't know, anyway. It's a news site for nerds. And yesterday on Slashdot, I was reading this thing, and there was a note there about there's a psychologist at, I think it was University of California, Davis, or somewhere, you know, and this psychologist is a world-renowned expert on learning. And there's actually, you know, on this thing, it's an interesting thing, you know, for me, because I'm a teacher and I want people to learn. And you know what? He said the best ways to learn is to learn something kind of, and then you kind of forget it. And you go as long as you can until it's almost unreconstructible again, okay? And then you figure it out again. And when you do it that way, you've actually learned it much better than if you come along and you wait just a few seconds and you refresh it, you wait a few seconds and you refresh it, you wait a few seconds and you refresh it or whatever, you know, and it's fresh and it's easy all the time, okay? You will actually, you know, if you stop doing that refresh process all the time, you will quickly forget that thing and you won't be able to remember it again. However, if you see it the first time and then you go just to the maximum amount before you can't reconstruct it again, and you reconstruct it again, then you have it much better and you will be able to remember it for a much longer time the next time, okay? Much longer than the first amount of space. You can go way, way longer, okay? And so that fits in very nicely. I was glad to read that because that fits in so nicely with my philosophy of deriving things, right? You know, deriving things is kind of like figuring it out in the first place, right? And so if you do that several times, you know, each time it's got to be a struggle to remember that thing. And the more of a struggle it is, such that you still could remember it, then it becomes really part of you. You really actually remember it much better. Okay? So maybe that will help you, you know, studying for your exams. I don't know. He also debunked my thing, and he said, what I do, you know, I have this thing where I say, well, you know, look, you're going to take the exam in this room, right? And if you want to do well on the exam, you should study in this room. Well, he said that was true. It is true. I mean, you know, I go to my office. I'm in my office. I think of something I need in the analog lab. I run up there, and I get up there, and I don't know how many times it's happened. I get up there. I can't remember what in the world I came up for. I sit there and think for a minute, and finally I give up and I go back down. As soon as I get to my office, it's all clear exactly what I was getting up there, and I go back up and get it, okay? Well, the same kind of things happens when you're studying. If you study in this room right here, we're going to take the exam in this room, you will actually do better on the exam. However, if you want to be able to use the same information that you learned in this room other places, you jolly well better study them other places. Otherwise, you will have the same problem I had when I ran upstairs and I couldn't remember what I came to get, right? So what my goal is to have you really have this in your mind, and you will use it anywhere, everywhere, wherever you go from here on, right? So I probably should not be encouraging you to study it here. It's only raising your score in this class and artificially making you think like you could do it anywhere, right? You will have to come right back here to this classroom to be able to do the work for your employer, which would be a sad thing, right?
So we should study in our future employer's office.
Yeah, you should study anywhere where you're going to need to be and do that. And maybe that means you should go to the beach, right?
No, because then you would be too comfortable and you wouldn't be paying attention unless you're on an Oregon beach.
I don't know. You know, I was very comfortable. I mean, maybe I shouldn't admit, but this was going through my brain on Sabbath afternoon. I was in the college or university church over here, and my daughter was singing in the choir because they had this choir clinic, and they were playing some really beautiful music, and the orchestra was that all these academy kids, you know, and I was there on like the second row, and I was kind of leaning back on the pew. It was a really comfy place there. And listening to the wonderful music, and you know, my mind went to this problem that Ben was asking me about over here, you know, this convergence problem, and that's when I, you know, got to thinking about this. This is exactly how this all plays out, you know. So, you know, you want to have those kind of places, you know, a nice place, because that's liable to be where you might come up with your great idea that makes you all millionaires, right?
Millionaires.
Yeah.
I never think of school when I'm.
Because by the time you're my age, maybe $1 million won't mean much.
I took a quiz the other day. It said, which would you rather have, $1 million and or this, or this, or this? And I said $1 million, because then if I had $1 million, I could buy the others.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes an electron hole pair. The photon hits it, gives it energy, which launches the electron. Now has more energy, and it can escape the orbit of the
of the
nucleus. You know, it can move, right? So it makes there's a hole and made in a hole an electron. There's a hole where the electron used to be, and the electron is over here, right? And if you can collect those electrons, you know, run them through a circuit back before they go back to the hole again, you got their energy.
And then another one just fills that
it's
place.
The same, could be the same electron comes around, goes through your circuit, because now it's got energy from the sun, right? It can go through your resistor, come back, and it'll end up in the very same hole, but probably it'll end up in some other electron's hole. But,
yeah.
You know, but I mean, it could possibly
it's
be the same.
Chairs.
Yeah, it's musical chairs, yeah. Musical chairs, thanks to the photons. Yeah, and you can make a phototransistor. Instead of putting a base current in, you shine a photon in. And the photon acts like the base current. It makes an electron hole pair over here in the base. And that makes a current go down this way, which makes all these electrons head up this way. And then they go flying out the collector if you have this, you know, to a potential so that it's downhill for them.
Okay.
Okay, suppose I have a transistor like this, you know, so it's kind of like this. So you got this whole electron up here, this is NPN, okay? And so instead of putting base current in here, like I normally would, to make it so there's all these electrons go flying up there, right?
Could you explain that to me again, because I was having a little...
Okay, so how does this work from the regular one here? So what happens is, maybe I should do this in red and black. Okay, so I'm going to make black the electrons, and this guy is the hole. So what I do is I dope. This is the emitter region down here. I put a little bit of voltage across here, maybe 0.7 volts or something, and then across here I put a big voltage, maybe 12 volts. Okay. So this 0.7 volts causes a current to go in there, right? Which means this hole is headed that way, right? And these electrons down here are all headed, you know, they're headed, a lot of them, I'll just make it, they're headed up, right?
Uh-huh.
And so what happens when they get up into the base region? They have to make a decision. And they make a decision where to go based on how, you know, how good the ride is. In other words, what's most downhill. And for them, going to 12 volt positive is like, oh, that's like really good. This, 0.7 volts, kind of, you know, crummy. So,
yeah,
you know, one of them comes out here, but most of them go like this.
Even though,
you know,
this is doped.
Yeah, it doesn't matter for them. This electron in here can go that way just fine, right? And see, what happens on a reverse bias p-n junction is this electron right here is going to want to go that way, right?
Mm.
And so he would leave, you know, no, all the electrons would leave kind of a electronless place here if you just had this p and that n. But this n down here sends electrons from here, up to there. If you didn't have this source of electrons down here, then you would just have holes, and these holes would go this direction, you know, just like that one did. And these electrons up here would go that direction. You'd end up with this place here without any carriers. If there's no carriers in that place, it's like an insulator.
And like, is that what this is for here?
So what this does is this makes it so it's slightly downhill for these electrons right here, okay? And to get from the emitter region into the base region. Once they're in the base region, they can feel this really big downhill this way, and they just keep heading up that way. If you didn't have this slightly downhill business, if this was flat, these electrons would never come over here.
Yeah, it'd be like trying to go.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yes, yeah, that's right. Exactly. Yes. So what I'm saying is on the phototransistor is just like the BJT transistor. They draw it like this without any wire coming out the base, and it's just like this. So this is the collector up here, and it's NPN, like this. But there's no wire here. So if you shine a photon in here like this, and it hits this base material just like a, you know, solar cell, it will excite, make whole electron pairs in this base material.
Make whole electron pairs.
Yeah, what it does is it takes the electrons and it gives them energy so that they can jump out of the orbit of their nuclei.
Okay.
And when they jump out, they leave a hole behind, and they're an electron, right? So all of a sudden there's a whole bunch of holes and electrons here, right? And the holes, of course, want to go that way, right? Because this is downhill and that's uphill, and this is 12 volts, this is 0 volts here. Holes are attracted toward the negative side of the battery. The electrons are attracted toward the positive side, and so current flows.
And then that combined with your voltage.
And so that makes a whole lot of current going down this way. This phototransistor doesn't make power. It uses this 12 volts to actually... But you can turn on the phototransistor by shining light on there instead of putting in a current. And it, now the solar cell, of course, is just a piece of silicon like this, you know, base material. And you shine light on it, and it the electron now has energy, and it hops away from its nucleus, leaving a hole behind. And that electron, of course, has got energy, so it could go through a resistor before it gets back to the hole, and it would be fine.
Hmm. And I was... this is usually silicon combined with phosphorus, and this is silicon combined with boron or something.
Yeah, right. And so this is, you know, silicon is a column 4 periodic table.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want it doped plus, you need to dope it with elements of a 3.
Right.
And if you want it doped minus, you need to dope it with elements of the 5. So
they're also saying they put a coat on of some sort of material that allows you to absorb more.
Yeah, they're trying to get as much of the light in as they can. Well, I don't even know if they're getting 40%. I mean, that's like getting a lot of, you know.
I read like
40,
like the best.
Best they've ever gotten was like 40. Yeah, well, probably, yeah, that's like the world record or something. And what you're happening is, you see, to get, if you have this silicon material, you know, here that's doped, and you shine a light on it, whatever, you know, and you make a hole here. And an electron, you know, just popped out of that hole right there. you know, what's the probability that that electron is going to go around through my circuit here like this? Or you know, when you try and grab him as quick as you can, you know, they put wires in on top of the photocell. You've seen those, right? You know, on the photocell. You look at a solar cell, a picture of a solar cell, you'll see all these grid of wires going across. Yeah, those grid of wires, to put those all over the place so they can grab this guy on that wire before he jumps back in his hole, right? Because if he jumps back in his hole, what happens? All your energy goes to heating up this silicon here. But if he goes back through the wire and back around like this to get to the hole, then all your energy is, you know, gone into heating up your resistor, which is what you want. Now, and what they're saying, 40%, you know, 40% means 40% of those electrons went through here. That's a really large percentage, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course there's some loss, you know, when this photon hits it. There's going to be what they call phonons, which are actually they're quantizations of the vibration of the lattice, which is basically heat. You know, it doesn't. This guy right here has to be exactly the right wavelength, which gives it just the right energy to jump this guy from here up to, you know, the next energy state. And if it doesn't have exactly the right energy, then the extra energy is wasted. And it goes into, you know, vibrations of the lattice, phonons, or some other thing. So, it's amazing to get 40%, you know. I think 10% is probably, you know, more likely. What, you go down and you buy a solar panel, that's about what you're getting, you know, because it's actually... Yeah, well, yeah, me too, because I'd like to bring my electric bill down. But so far at this point, solar cells, they're coming down in price. I've seen them down to about $1 a watt, which is really, you know, good compared to what they have been. But I haven't seen them for $1 a watt at any time when I liked the solar panels that were $1 a watt. And... you know, when I was ready to jump into the big project of, you know, erecting a bunch of them. But
I was reading, it said on like a sunny day, which could be a pretty big thing, but
yeah.
It said on a sunny day, like a square meter can get 1,000 watts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
So it seems like...
So I'm not worried so much about the square meters and the efficiency, like you are 40%. Doesn't matter to me because I live on a hill and I've got like many, many, many square meters, right? What I'm worried about is the cost for the solar cells.
Yeah. That's something that Professor Eckert was talking to me about.
Right, yeah.
But I guess, you know, like I'm thinking in the city and stuff like that where...
Sure, sure.
Space,
yeah, where people have that problem, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, I don't have unlimited space, but I have way more space than I can afford to cover with solar cells, right? I mean, even if I just look at my roof. And actually, you know, I'm thinking about things, you know, not just solar cells, because...
Solar cells are expensive and inefficient.
Yeah, that's right. I'm thinking of, you know, one of my big expenses, I pay a lot for electricity. And my father-in-law and mother-in-law moved in with us, and when they moved in, our electric bill like doubled. And it wasn't because they used as much electricity as all the rest of us, because there's four of us and only two of them. But what happens is that the electric rates go up as your usage goes up. So, you know, if you're a big family, they charge you more than if you're a small family. Well, I don't know that it's exponential, but it, you know, ours doubled, and so.
Well, also it could be that they're at home more.
Yeah, they're at home more, and they're using more electricity probably than, because I'm not at home. But
normally during the day, you are, when you aren't home.
Yeah, I'm somewhere else.
All your lights are off, all your
right.
Power's down.
Right.
Nobody is home.
Yep, that's right. And, you know, so anyway, one thing I'm looking at is I'm trying to reduce the hot water, which we pay for through electricity because it's a hot water heater, electric hot water heater. And if we put a solar hot water heater on the roof, that would actually be a, you know, that's a much, much higher efficiency and much lower cost per watt than solar cells, you know. And so if I can, I could do that, I would do that before I would buy a whole bunch of solar cells, you know, to heat my electric, you know, heat my water. Yeah, and there's things like, you know, I think about all this hot water. Say you take a shower, right? Where does that hot water go? It goes right down into your septic system, right? You should really run that through a heat exchanger, right? And get that, that energy back out of that hot water before you just send it off to, you know, all those little microbes in the septic system. Oh, probably like the hot water too because it keeps them warm, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, this I'm interested in solar cells too. It's an interesting thing. You got to talk to Fred Librand. He's there's actually some solar cells up on the roof of this building, I think, that, you know, he was involved in doing, and he's been doing, you know, some stuff with solar cells.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So you've been in his class already then. Yeah.
This is some homework or lecture notes that.
Yeah, those are probably homeworks coming back that didn't get. Did you find yours?
Yeah.
Okay. Alan missed his and Travis missed his. They were both here.
A few questions for you.
Yeah.
Are you going to
I'm headed to my office, yeah.